The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Oh, and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, coming to you from our studio, this time not in Edstone, England, but in Edmond, Oklahoma. It's my first time recording in this cavernous studio. On video, it kind of looks like the Edstone, Edmond studio are about the same size. This is huge. I mean, it's not quite basketball court size, but it's a gigantic studio. So it's great. It's a really fun behind the scenes look for me on this trip, seeing what where Mr. Flurry usually records. It's my first time back at the headquarters campus for about 8 years, so it's great to be back. It's amazing to see how much the campus has changed. I want to talk about that a bit more in the second half. But first today, I wanted to talk about just the shocking police or migrant violence that we've seen in France over the last week or so. We've got a bit of footage that we can play. I think a lot of this is over the weekend, but it's been some dramatic protests. Over 700 businesses burned, 1,300 cars torched. You had one fireman died. He was trying to put out the flames in an underground car park and died trying to do that. 45,000 officers deployed on the streets. And it looked like that was what was necessary to help bring at least a little bit of calm. Over 2,000 rioters arrested, 500 police officers injured, schools attacked, cultural centers attacked. The rioters went after the family of the right-wing mayor of... Apparently having to say hard-to-pronounce French words on the Trumpet Daily is my thing for the last couple of shows. Le Hay Les Roses, something like that. Les Roses. That sounds Spanish. Anyway, mayor of some place. But it was pretty horrific what happened there. They were driving a burning car into his house. One of his children was injured. His wife broke a leg while she was trying to get out of this house before it burned down. The town's police chief, he said, people talk about riots, but for those of us who have to deal with this, it's not riots, it's war. And these riots, they spread to Switzerland and Belgium. You had seven arrested in Lausanne, where you had teens and other young people trying to smash shop windows. That's in the French-speaking part of Switzerland. You had others throwing paving stones. There was at least one Molotov cocktail in Switzerland thrown at police. Belgium, 64 arrested in Brussels. You had one youth accused of attacking a police officer. Protests going on there. I mean, this is, even for a country where protests and strikes are kind of a national sport. In England, we like to make fun of the French for always protesting at the drop of a hat, and they go on strike for whatever trivial reason. They one less cube of sugar in your tea or something. Much as we might joke about that, these are pretty extreme riots. I mean, this is outside of the just your normal protest that you can have in France. They're the worst riots easily since 2005. And they'll have pretty major implications for France. They got started after you had Nahul Marzouk. He was a migrant. We'll play the video in just a second. But basically on June 27th, he was shot. And the police said... He was trying to ram his car into them, and so they had no choice but to shoot him. And then this is the video that circulated on social media showing what happened.
Ils ont tiré, wesh. Eh, c'est fini pour lui.
So they had him at a traffic stop. The guy has a gun pointed to his head. He drives off, and the policeman pulls the trigger, shoots him in the head, and the car goes off and crashes. And according to the media reports, the police officer was saying, "I'm going to shoot you in the head," before this happened. So I don't want to get too much into the rights and wrongs of it, but he's driving away from a traffic stop. He is somebody that I think had a criminal history. I don't know what all that history is. I don't think that's even been published. So, if he hadn't have pulled the trigger, well, then would you have this police chase and goes along, kill some family in a car or something like that? And then all the questions would be to the police, well, why didn't you shoot? But certainly they made things look pretty dodgy by the way that they said, well, he was trying to ram us. And then the video comes out and shows that that's not the case. Anyway, the video went viral. The police were caught, lying about this. And it sparked a lot of accusations against police about police violence against black Muslim minorities. So Mazouk, this guy that was shot, he was of Algerian and Moroccan descent. And you've got a lot of people in France that have come in from France's former colonies, and they're concentrated generally in these poorer neighborhoods. They feel kind of alienated from society. They rioted before. There's been a lot of this kind of migrant violence before. And so it played into all of that, and the riots just exploded. But these riots, they highlight and they widen a divide in France that has critical implications, not just for France, but all of Europe. So over 10% of France's population was born outside of its borders. They had a large influx of migrants from colonies in Algeria and Morocco, and they've never really integrated into French society. The migrants will claim that, they claim, well, we've been denied opportunities because of racism. The French say, well, no, the opportunities are there, but you need to embrace French society and French culture and let go of your own traditions. And this has fed into a lot of even French law, where they've kind of cracked down on headscarves and head coverings and Muslim swimsuits and that kind of thing. But these migrants, they've also been shunted into just these impoverished districts of France's big cities. So they're congregated there. The elites of France never see them, never threatened by any violence there, and so don't really do anything. Meanwhile, the poorer French have to are affected by a lot of this minorities' violence. And these cities kind of, or these districts become basically no-go zones. The police aren't welcome. The police don't go there. And so you've got 6 million people. So again, about 10% of the country living in what the government calls urban policy priority districts. They deliberately, just like a whole lot of countries in Europe, they deliberately do not collect a lot of statistics about this. They want it very hard for people to be able to talk about some of this migrant violence. I mean, this is just a side point. It just occurs to me now, but because we were recently working on that Pride edition of the Trumpet magazine, and one of the challenges writing about that, I guess we probably don't have a copy back from the printers yet, but one of the challenges writing about that is there are not good statistics. And as a writer, we have the truth from the Bible, but you're wanting to put these things across and get to the facts and give people the facts. And when it comes to LGBT, there's studies that have been small studies that were done in the early 90s, and then often that's it, no more studies. Because it was clear from those studies where this was heading, and I think they just wanted to make sure there was no high quality data. So those studies disappear, and it's kind of the same, it's a completely different subject, some of these migrant problems in Europe, same approach. They want to make sure there's no data available. So, because it makes it hard to talk about, hard to get to the facts and be authoritative about. Anyway, that's about some of the best that we can get, that 10% live in these urban policy priority districts. And so after these shootings, while these districts are convinced that authorities are out to get them and people are stirring that up, but then, of course, there's another side of France that just saw their towns and communities torched. And they're scared and they're angry. And these riots, they're bad. They were worse we've had for years. They're not new. And this migrant violence, this is not something that we just discovered this week, that there's migrant violence in France. These happen every few years. And then these riots take place against a steady background of Islamist attacks in Europe. So on June 6th, you had a Syrian migrant stab people in a park in southeastern France, including four young children between 1 and 3 years old. They're getting stabbed by some migrant from Syria. You're having similar things all across Europe. So Sweden, 15-year-old boy killed, 3 injured in a shooting in Stockholm. It was an unrelated shooting the day before, 3 injured. You've got gang violence coming up there. It is a long-term problem. It's actually something Donald Trump spoke about. He had a clip that's been kind of going around in Twitter where he talks about this. I should have noted down the year. It'll probably be on the clip. But here's Donald Trump talking about this long-standing problem in France.
You see what happened to the French priest. A friend of mine, he said he was going to France like 3-4 months ago. I saw him yesterday. I said, how'd you like France? He said, I wouldn't go to France. I wouldn't go to France because France is no longer France. France is no longer France. They won't like me for saying that. But you see what happened in Nice. You see what happened yesterday with the priest who was supposed to be a spectacular man. France is no longer France. And this world better be very careful, and they better get very tough and very smart.
And he called it, talked about it in his typically blunt way. I think looking at that, you can see on the podium, it says Trump Pence. So that must have been from when he was running. Either in for the 2020 or 2016 elections. So this has been going on for a while, but it also means that those in power in France have failed to fix this for a while. You've got the French president Emmanuel Macron. He's become more and more extreme in his rhetoric. He's given the police power to shut down mosques and kick out preachers. He's outlawed homeschooling. That's primarily to stop Muslim children from avoiding the French education system. You've got the French interior minister. He's dissolved dozens of French Muslim organizations. He's deported radicals. Macron gave a landmark speech in 2020. He said, Islam is a religion living through a crisis today everywhere in the world. So, you know, we've seen some big changes from Emmanuel Macron. We've seen him say things that only the kind of the more extreme would say years and years ago. And it's quite clearly not fixed the problem. So, you know, if you are in France and you're concerned about what's happening, quite rightly, well, what do you do? Where do you go? Who do you vote for? Who's going to solve it? And this, you know, there's a lot of news outlets. I made this point, I think, on Trumpet Hour last Friday. You know, there's a lot of news outlets talking about the parallel between what is happening in France and the Black Lives Matter movement in the US, and I think there are a lot of parallels. But there are also crucial differences. And one of those is just the way in which these riots in France are leading to a clash of civilizations. You know, those that want to defend their families and their towns, they're looking for new champions now. And that is what's going to push this radical change that's coming in France. Unheard had a good article on Monday. They said that they wrote, the events of this past week are most likely to benefit the far right, possibly even bring it to power in the next presidential election. France is becoming more authoritarian and more Catholic in response to this chaotic Muslim-led violence. And that's not intended as criticism of any particular religion, but that's a statement of what is happening now in France. And that's critical to watch because that's a fulfillment of a very specific Bible prophecy or a series of very specific Bible prophecies. You've got National Rally. They are this fringe political party. They're the successor to the National Front in France. They're kind of associated with the Le Pen family. They've had various different members of the Le Pen family lead them. It's been kept out of power for decades. It's generally considered too extreme to be allowed in government. And the National Front's founder, Jean-Marie Le Pen, he had a history of anti-Semitism, of Holocaust denial. He did say some pretty terrible things. And since he's kind of left, the party's worked hard to distance itself from him. But still, I think there's a lot of unsavory baggage that comes with that party. And then its anti-migrant, its anti-Muslim stance means it's often labeled far right. I think if you look at its economic policy especially, but even its foreign policy, far left would be a better label. I think last time I looked, you know, they change their platforms every few elections, but last time I looked, they wanted to quit NATO, for example. They blame America as the source of a lot of evils in terms of foreign policy. They tend to be more leaning towards Russia and pro-Russia, and their economic policies are outright socialism, if not communism. So, I mean, that blend of far right, far left, that's what National Socialism, that's what the Nazi Party was as well. But either way, you know, this is still a fairly extreme party, and it's closer than ever to power. All the different mainstream parties in France have basically split, and they're divided. National Rally is stuck together. And ahead of the riots, Marine Le Pen was the second most popular leader in France. You know, if you want an alternative for Macron, just generally, she's one of the more credible ones. And then if you want somebody, if you're saying, well, Macron's not strong enough. He said he was going to crack down on migrant violence. He said he was going to stand up for law and order. He's not done so. Who do you vote for? I mean, she's pretty much the only option. These riots could usher Le Pen to power and a new era for France. You'd have a strong leader. You'd have a much more overtly Christian France. And radical Islamist violence in France in recent years, it's brought Christianity much, much more into politics. This is something Le Pen has played a big role in. She'll talk about that often. This will come up now quite regularly in elections. Macron has responded as well by becoming more overtly Christian. Roger Brubaker, several years ago, he had an article for the Atlantic magazine. He's at the University of California, Los Angeles, or at least he was when he gave this interview. He made some great points. He talked about Le Pen's religion as a secularized Christianity as culture. He said it's a matter of belonging rather than believing. He talked about it as a Christianity that says we are Christian precisely because they are Muslim. Otherwise, we are not Christian in any substantive sense. So they've been adopting this, and you see the same trend underway in Germany, where you've got the Alternative for Deutschland reaching new heights of popularity. If I get a chance, I might talk about them a little bit as well. There's been some fairly important news with them. But even so, you're seeing this push bringing Le Pen along, and this push for more Christian rhetoric, Catholic rhetoric. But even without Le Pen, the riots are making France more authoritarian. Macron has been criticized for partying while Paris burns, but he's already signaled he wants more control over social media. He's blamed them for this attack and for this video circulating. He said platforms and networks are playing a major role in the events of recent days. Snapchat, TikTok, several other service places where violent gatherings have been organized, but there's also a form of mimicry of the violence, which for some young people leads them to lose touch with reality. You get the impression that for some of them, they are experiencing on the street the video games that have intoxicated them. So that seems like that's where he's going to focus his response, cracking down on free speech online and regulating social media. But this movement that you're seeing, this pushing in France in all of its different aspects for a more authoritarian, anti-Islamist, Christian Europe, that's one that we've talked about for years, that the Trumpet has, that Herbert W. Armstrong has. And faced with the violence of last week, it's easy to see why so many in France would embrace a more authoritarian, anti-Islamist Christian Europe. I mean, you know, Le Pen's party has like all this horrible or some pretty disturbing historical baggage. But like I said, at the same time, you can understand why people vote for them. If that seems like the only alternative to stopping people driving flaming cars into houses of city mayors and getting the country back under control. But this is all putting Europe in exactly the direction that Herbert W. Armstrong talked about. I mean, we have this free booklet, He Was Right, that goes through in detail and specifically all of these different prophecies, all of these different things Mr. Armstrong talked about. And those riots in France are pushing Europe towards those in quite a few different ways. And Mr. Armstrong talked about the role that Catholicism would play in uniting Europe. He said, for example, in August 1978 in the Good News magazine, Europeans want their own united military power. They have made a real effort towards union in the common market, but they well know that there is but one possible union in Europe, and that is through the Vatican. And so, based on that, he forecasts where we're going to see Europe become more Christian, the Vatican play a more political role, and this is pushing for more politicized Christianity, politicized Catholicism. Revelation 17, it describes a Europe dominated by this church as a woman that sits upon many waters. It talks about her power stretching over vast portions of the earth. That's what it means by ruling over many waters. And in the Bible, a woman represents a church. And it says the kings of the earth have committed fornication with this woman. She's a major political power. So there's a prophecy here of the Catholic Church having major power in Europe. These attacks in France, or these violence in France, is pushing Europe into that direction. This book also describes, or Revelation 17, it describes 10 kings who receive power as part of this empire that the woman leads. That these are 10 strong authoritarian leaders. You know, they're kings. They're not presidents. They're not prime ministers. They're not 10 committees. And Mr. Armstrong, you know, here's a chapter. There's a section in there that talks about the Catholic Church. There's a section in here that talks about Europe heading in a more authoritarian direction. And with the chaos on the streets of France this last week, you can see that happening as well. Quickly. The book of Daniel is another key book about Bible prophecy that fits hand in glove with the book of Revelation. Daniel chapter 11 talks about at the time of the end, you have this European king of the north goes to war with an Islamist king of the south. And you see that building in France with this Islamist violence and a cry for some kind of response to that. So Europe is clearly heading in the direction that the Bible forecasts in detail, that we have so many of these specific prophecies. They're on the brink of being fulfilled. You can see them being fulfilled. They're half fulfilled or some fraction of the way fulfilled. That it's coming to pass already. And now is the time to really prove these Bible prophecies for yourself. To don't just take my word for it that Revelation 17 is talking about Europe or that Daniel 11 is talking about Europe. Mr. Armstrong would say that all the time. Don't believe me, believe your Bible. Now's the time to prove this for yourself so that then you can watch these events be fulfilled exactly the way the Bible said. And that just really brings it alive. You know, it's really powerful and impactful to kind of be told, yeah, this event happened, or to study and read about this event that happened in the past was prophesied in the Bible, and it happened exactly the way that the Bible said it would happen. You know, that's really dramatic and inspiring. But I think there's just some extra drama and in inspiration from studying that Bible prophecy, say, okay, this is going to happen, and then sitting there watching it happen in your news. I think it just really powerfully brings to life that the Bible is a now book about this world, that when it talks about this world, we can rely on it. And then when it talks about changes that we need to make in our own lives, we can rely on it. When it gives us a hope for the future, we can rely on it. It really brings that to life. I mean, one place that kind of goes through and explains a lot of these prophecies about Europe is our book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. You can go and read and study that, for example, or He Was Right. It doesn't matter. I mean, well, pick one. Pick a book. Dig into it. Study it. We'd be happy to send it to you and prove it for yourself. Watch these news events happening before your eyes. 1-866-930-3024 is the free phone number where you can order that, or you can email us at td@thetrumpet.com. You can get a lot of those on our website. Well, there are another news story or two I wanted to bring to you quickly. Here's one from the UK that I haven't seen getting any traction in the US yet, but I think will be coming to America very, very soon and is pretty scary. This is what some highlights from a video. It's about 10 minutes long. Our staff here cut it down a bit. But this is a video that he made and released on Twitter.
I've been living with something for the last couple of months that may well fundamentally affect my future career going on from here, and whether I can even stay living in this country. I have Been with the same banking group since 1980. I've had my personal accounts with them since that date, and my business accounts right through the 1990s. I'm with one of the subsidiaries of this big banking group, one with a very prestigious name, but I won't name them just yet. I got a phone call a couple of months ago to say, we are closing your accounts. I asked why. No reason was given. I was told a letter would come which would explain everything. The letter came through and simply said, we are closing your accounts. We want to finish it all by a date, which is around about now. I thought, well, there we are. I'll have to go and find a different bank. I've been to seven banks, actually. Asked them all, could I have a personal and a business account? And the answer has been no in every single case. There is nothing irregular or unusual about what I do. The payments that go in and come out every month are pretty much the same. But then the banks, you see, themselves are part of the big corporate structures in this country. These are the organizations who did not want Brexit to happen. And I think in my case, probably the corporate world will never, ever forgive me. Because they know if I hadn't done what I did with the help of thousands of people in our People's Army, there never would have been a referendum, let alone a victory. I'm the one that is to carry the blame.
And this is one of the new trends here in the UK is banks shutting down the accounts of people they disagree with. And Nigel Farage is probably the most high profile. And so because of him, it's finally getting some attention. But it's something I've got a few examples here. I think I saw even more on Twitter where just him posting this video has brought a lot of people out of the woodwork saying, well, yeah, I campaign for this. And it's a lot of... you know, he's big and high profile, but it's more like local politics and, you kind of show up at your local council or that kind of thing and say the wrong kind of things, or you stand for election as a local political figure, you say the wrong kind of thing, you can have your bank account cancelled. And as he says, well, I mean, in a modern society, it's hard to operate without a bank account. It's hard to even just exist in a country without a bank account. And he posted an update on Twitter, I think today, saying he's now tried 9 banks. They've all told him, no, we're not giving you a bank account. So you had Mark Collette and Laura Towler. They founded a group, Patriotic Alternative, to campaign against migration. They had their bank accounts closed. You had a Brexit Party member of the European Parliament in 2019. Her account was closed. PayPal froze the account of Toby Young. They eventually backed down. This one really, it feels like it kind of happened to anyone, where you have Yorkshire Building Society. So you know how these big companies, they send out, like, we'd love to hear from you type of emails. Give us your feedback. So they sent this out asking for feedback. And this one guy responded, well, okay, seeing as you're asking for my input, why do you have to have so many pride flags around your bank? I don't need that you don't need to be pushing some kind of message for me to bank with you. And it was just a pretty mild response. And it's not like he went up to the bank and started yelling at this at them. Though, I don't know, I wouldn't blame him too much if he did. It is really frustrating when you see these everywhere. But they asked him for his feedback. He gave his feedback. Shut his bank account down. Got rid of him. And so... you're reaching this position where if you're taking a public stance against some of these establishment beliefs, like for here in the UK, if you take a public stance against the European Union, if you take a public stance against the homosexual movement, you risk having your bank account shut down. They called Nigel Farage a politically exposed person, and so they're saying, well, we don't want to do business with you. And Farage, he's written about this in the Telegraph. He's talked about how everyone used to be entitled to a bank account in the UK at the post office, but the post office has been privatized. That's not an option now. But he said, without a bank account, you become a non-person. And that kind of is how it is. Now, the Conservative government has kind of said, well, we're going to step in and we're going to look at this and we're going to try and set up some rules so that people don't have their bank accounts shut down for no good reason. I mean, I'm skeptical they've also stepped in and said, well, they've also said, well, we're going to stop migrants coming to the country in small boats, and that's not happened. They said we're going to stop homosexual propaganda in schools, and that's not happened. They're good at saying, well, we're going to step in and fix this problem, and they never seem like they do anything. But it's a pretty chilling example. But what came to my mind reading and hearing about this is Revelation chapter 13 and the mark of the beast. I mean, I'm absolutely not saying that bank accounts are the mark of the beast or anything like that. Do not get me wrong there. But it talks about that you've got a beast power that says we're not going to, you cannot buy or sell without our permission. And if you reject this mark or we decide we disapprove with you, you cannot buy or sell. And that's what the Bible says is coming in this European beast power, that they will enforce that and they'll say, well, you can't buy or sell. And one of the things that's talked about in our book, America Under Attack, is that beast power is going to be led by a man prophesied in Daniel chapter 8, this Antiochus figure. And you have that Antiochus there, and this empire led by this Antiochus says no man can buy or sell. And you've got another Antiochus type leading America. And America is absolutely not enforcing the mark of the beast. Not saying that. But you see that same spirit of you do something we disagree with, and then we will cut off your ability to buy and sell. And like I said, you're starting to see this with banks in England being pushed by this same kind of ESG or corporate social responsibility or diversity and inclusion. I've forgotten the term that kind of BlackRock is trying to push, environability, so environment, social and governance, something like that. Anyway, it's a movement that's been pushed from the United States. They're getting on board with this kind of woke banking type of thing. And as part of that, they're shutting down bank accounts of people that they disagree with. And you have to think you start seeing that in the United States as well. I mean, in America Under Attack, in this book, Mr. Flurry writes, the complicity among the political class, including Democrats, Republicans, the news media, and others, is far deeper than Americans realize. The amount of power, money, influence, technology, and intimidation they wield is staggering. And then you start to see this now where it's like, okay, you disagree with us, non-person, no bank account, you can't buy or sell, you can't work for anybody, you can't, at least not, you look at someone like Nigel Farage and the type of salaries that he would be receiving and that kind of thing. It's not £10 an hour working at McDonald's. He's got a business that he runs and things. Can't do that. I'm not sure whether it was in that clip or not, but they were saying personal bank account, business bank account, neither of those. You can't have either. Well, I just wanted to cover. I'll also just point to you. If you have not, we've plugged this a fair bit, but if you have not got your copy, be sure to get your copy of America Under Attack. I've grabbed the soft copy. We have the hardback copy with some extra content in there. We'd be very happy to send you that. You can read that online. You can order your copy by giving us a call, 1-866-930-3024, or on our website, thetrumpet.com. And like I said, don't take my word for what the Bible says. Get the copy, prove it for yourself, and then watch that prophecy be fulfilled for yourself, and have that experience of seeing Bible prophecy fulfilled before your eyes. Well, I just thought I'd mention quickly, because when I was last on this show, I was talking about the Alternative for Deutschland. And they had their first election to a political office a couple of weeks ago. Now they've had their first mayoral candidate elected in Saxony-Anhalt, where once again you have the AfD and every other political party in Germany saying vote for someone else, and they still won. So some pretty big developments underway in Germany, just like you're seeing France having, you'll see these riots kind of push France in a more authoritarian direction. Watch for that exact same trend within Germany. This headline, this was from Remix, it caught my eye. Enormous power grab, Germany, France want to end veto rights in the EU this year, where Germany and France are trying to agree to, they're trying to push this agreement, and they're hoping to get it done by the end of the year to get rid of veto rights within the European Union. And this sounds kind of technical, but this is huge. One of the biggest things that has stopped Europe move towards a super state is the fact that Malta or Luxembourg or even one region of Belgium can kind of come forwards and veto the whole thing and bring whatever projects they're moving forwards to a screeching halt. So moving forwards to this would be one, or if they remove the veto, that would be one of the most significant steps possible, really, for Europe towards a super state. And again, watch for that. That's what the Bible prophesies, that you'll have a union of 10 nations. Well, we'll take a quick break. When we get back, we'll have a little bit of a Bible study based on some of my experiences coming back to visit headquarters after a long absence. But we'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. The world is hopelessly confused about Bible history and prophecy. Understanding the Daniel 2 image could clear up most of that confusion. The Daniel 2 image gives an overview of history and prophecy like nothing else in the Bible. The Bible is a masterful work that should be studied in its entirety. The book of Daniel and the images described therein actually unlock the meaning of the prophecies in the book of Revelation. Our free booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, explains the incredible prophecies contained in these two books. Studied alongside your Bible, this booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, will bring the history and prophecy of your Bible to life. Request your free copy today. There is absolutely no cost or obligation. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Show, coming to you live from our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma. Or not coming to you live, I guess. We're not live today. We're giving you a recording, but coming to you nonetheless from our studio here. As I mentioned at the start, this is my first time back here in a long time. It's really exciting to be. It's been really inspiring to walk around the campus here, and that's what I want to talk about, because that physical campus teaches just a multitude of lessons, and I just wanted to talk about one. I'm getting maybe into the bad habit of having segments based on my reactions of visiting somewhere, and I guess this is the latest in that series. But there really is a very practical and inspiring message, or several, in visiting God's campus here. You know, I went to college here, lived here for a few months after college. I think I last visited in 2015, and none of those times could you call this campus ugly. It's always beautiful. But coming back after being away for several years, I was really impressed with just how much it's changed and how much more beautiful it is. And I think there's a real message, like I said, I think there's several messages, but one that I want to focus on is there's a message there around just striving for perfection. And that's what immediately kind of came to my mind walking around this campus. I mean, there's new buildings since I was last here. There's the Dwight Armstrong Performing Arts Center. There's new tennis courts. There's some more sports facilities. There's new water features and paths and viewing areas. And like I said, I think there's a practical message in how much this changed about a passion for perfection. There's just a constant push to improve that is going on just even in the physical environment and you know, in so much more. You know, the studio is bigger and better than when I was last here. There's always these, you know, everything. We're always trying to do everything better. God's work is always focused on that, and that's reflected just even in the physical environment. And Mr. Armstrong talked about this passion for perfection and tied it in with the beautiful campuses that the work has when he wrote an April 1965 co-worker letter. He wrote in that co-worker letter, he said, "Did you know that God is a workman? You and I are each a piece of his workmanship. He said, he is building godly spiritual character in those of us who will submit to the process. And he quotes Ephesians 2 and verse 10. I guess I'll just turn there quickly. Where it says, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk in them." We are a project that God is working on, you could say. And Mr. Armstrong said, "And God is not going to settle for cheap, sloppy, careless, inferior bit of workmanship." We are God's workmanship, and he wants to produce the best product, the best result, the best project that he can. And he quotes Matthew chapter 5 and verse 48, saying, "Be you therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." And he had this very memorable conclusion where he writes, "A careless workman once complained to me, 'The trouble with you, Mr. Armstrong, is that you are a perfectionist.' I guess he was right. He should tell God, 'The trouble with you, God, is that you are a perfectionist. God is a perfectionist, and so am I. How about you?'" And there's a message this campus teaches about a passion for perfection, and it makes it very practical. You know, a passion for perfection. Well, that's kind of a nice slogan. What does it mean? Well, you can see that. You can see, well, how do we implement a passion for perfection? And you see that in the campus. I mean, first, just to put it very simply, you get busy doing stuff. You know, you make improvements, even if it's going to take a long time to pay off. You know, maybe I'm a little biased coming from England, but I don't tend to think that Oklahoma is naturally all that beautiful. Maybe that's a terrible thing to say, but you know, I like mountains and I like forests, and Oklahoma tends not to have either. I guess I don't know what the point of the panhandle in Oklahoma is. I wonder it's so that they could just have a little bit of a mountain in there. But it's a lot of just kind of red dirt and scrawny vegetation. You know, Oklahoma doesn't have many trees that are all that tall. Somebody once pointed out to me when I was a student, and I thought it was pretty funny, that Oklahoma state tree is the Eastern Redbud. And you know, you can try this. Go on Wikipedia. I don't usually use Wikipedia as the source for the shows, but this doesn't really matter, so it's fine. But if you go on Wikipedia, it says, "The Eastern Redbud is a large deciduous shrub." The state tree of Oklahoma is literally a shrub. And that tells you all you need to know about Oklahoma in terms of tree cover. There are not many trees. And this campus was once just a field. I think I'd like to go back now and look at some of the video footage and pictures of what it was like when they first bought it. I mean, I was living back in England and pretty young at that time. I didn't get to see it in that state. Mr. Flurry, I'm sure, could talk much more about that. But I think it would have been so easy to move here and think, well, look, we live in urgent times. There isn't much time left. You know, making this kind of scrubland look really beautiful is going to be hard. I mean, we'll make it functional and we'll make it, you know, not terrible, but we'll do okay and we'll leave it at that. And honestly, that's probably what I would have done. But I'm glad we didn't. You know, God, Mr. Flurry, Mr. Thompson, everyone involved in that project had so much more vision than that. And maybe it seemed like a huge, impossible task at the start to take this kind of red dirt plot in Oklahoma and really beautify it. But they started, and it would have taken a lot of vision to go and plant these trees, and they're huge now. There's so much more. I mean, that's one of the things that makes a big difference. Just walking around campus, there's so much more tree cover now. They're much bigger. They're green. You know, there are. Bits of campus you could call a small forest. It was really impressive seeing that. And just to think about, you know, when I came to college, those trees had already been growing for a pretty decent length of time. Somebody, you know, people had, or ultimately inspired by God, had vision to get started on what must have seemed just an impossible and certainly a very long-ranging project. Well, let's start some trees. And they're not going to grow. It's going to take them a long time before they kind of reach their most beautiful. But we'll get started. We'll do what we can to beautify this campus. So, you know, for a passion of perfection, we need to get started. We need to do things. And sometimes it can seem pretty daunting. We can see a lot of things that we need to change in our lives. And it can be easy to say, or to kind of back off and just think, well, it's just too hard. What's the point in even trying? There's just too much. But we just need to get started. Maybe it will be a long process. Hard things to overcome and to change take time. We can't let that stop us. We just have to get started and take a step forward. And maybe it's a small step, and maybe it's going to take a long time to reach where we want to be. But we can get started and get moving in that direction. And then I think another lesson that I was thinking about in terms of a passion of perfection, just walking and seeing this beautified campus is, well, then don't stop. I think there's probably many points in time where the landscaping crew and those in charge and ultimately, you know, Mr. Flurry and God could have stopped and said, well, look, it's beautiful now. It's good enough. Just maintain what we have. We don't need any new projects. We don't need any new things added. But instead, you know, part of a passion for perfection is a constant striving for better, striving for improvement. Okay, it's beautiful now. You know, like I said, by the time I got to campus, a whole lot of work had been done when I arrived as a student, and it was beautiful. And it got more beautiful throughout my time as a student. Coming back a few years after I graduated and looking at it, it was beautiful. It was more beautiful. It had been improved. And it would have been easy, I'm sure, at so many points around there to say, well, it's good enough. Stop now. But there's just continual growth and continual improvement. And walking around now, it's like, wow, there's a new waterfall there. And there's a new lake here. And there's a new recreation area here. And there's a new path and river system here. And there's a lesson visiting headquarters that we can apply to our own physical environments. I'm motivated when I go home to, you know, work harder to constantly improve just my own physical environment, office, home, garden, seeing how uplifting it is to be in a positive physical environment. And one of the points that Mr. Armstrong makes in that coworker letter, because he talks about some that would kind of criticize it as extravagance or this kind of thing, is he talks about it he made the point that a lot of times it's not necessarily about spending more money. And some of the things that he did to make the Pasadena campus more beautiful, he kind of puts all the evidence out there. And he says, well, look, it's not that we're spending a lot of money. It's about putting the effort in and the attention and the focus in and having that vision and making those decisions. And he's like, yeah, well, we did it this way and it's beautiful. And that wasn't any more expensive than doing it this other way that would have been ugly. So I think there's a lesson just in terms of physically having an uplifting environment, and I learned a lesson about that. But there's a lesson too about just constant growth in our own lives and never settling, never stopping and kind of being, well, that's good enough. And just leaving it there, but always working to reach a higher standard and a higher standard and bring more perfection or strive closer towards perfection into that. And this is something I've been thinking about since during the days of Unleavened Bread. And it kind of reminded me of that as well, where I was just looking at myself and thinking about, well, I think I kind of have a tendency to identify a problem, identify a weakness or see a weakness, work on it until maybe to my mind, it's maybe not this massive glaring weakness, and then say, well, it's good enough, and then move on to something else and just leave it at, well, it's good enough. And there's a lot of problems with that approach. You know, a problem dealt with that way where we just kind of, it's not fixed, but it's good enough, and we leave it and move on. It's going to get worse. It's going to come back. It's going to be an issue again. But then also you just look around this campus and see this message of constant improvement and beauty. And really, you know, we really want in all areas of our lives just always be striving for perfection and improvement. And so God wants us to have this same passion for perfection in our own lives. And he will use us to have the same, he wants to, this is a key part of even why he's working with us, why God is calling people out, why God has humanity in existence at all. So he wants us to develop a passion for perfection in our lives, and then he wants us to use this same passion for perfection in beautifying the whole earth. And God will help us with this. He helped. I'm sure he's helped a lot physically on this campus. I'm sure if you talk to those that are working in landscaping, that they could tell you about all kinds of miracles that he's provided here. I think, because Mr. McDonald, I think, is over that at the moment. I remember a message he gave, I think it was a year or two ago. He talked about just some of the miracles God has provided. He provides us help. He can, even just in this physical passion for perfection, if we take that to him. But then he absolutely works miracles for us overcoming our problems. You know, we need those miracles. We cannot build a holy, righteous character by ourselves. We're fundamentally, completely, and totally incapable of doing that. You know, striving towards God's perfect, righteous character requires miracles, requires power from God, but he promises to provide that. He will provide that. Mr. Armstrong, in that co-worker letter, he takes Isaiah 58, verses 9 to 16. He takes it in the Moffat translation and chops it up a bit, cuts a few bits out to condense it, adds in a few thoughts of his own. I thought it was quite powerful. I'll read you the way that he quoted that passage. He said, "If you will do away with all oppression, if you bestow your bread upon the hungry," and he notes, as this work is doing spiritually, "then light shall dawn for you in darkness, and evermore shall the Eternal guide you, guarding you without fail, as he graciously does for this work," notes Mr. Armstrong. "He will refresh you in dry places and renew your strength till you are like a watered garden." And he says the college campus is becoming a beautiful watered garden, "like an oasis with a steadfast spring. Your son shall build once more the ancient ruins, and the old foundation shall you raise again, and you shall be called the repairer of ruins, the restorer of wrecked homes." And there's a wonderful picture there. God says you are going to be like a watered garden. You are going to be like a beautiful campus. That same attitude of this campus being constantly beautified, that reflects God the Father's attitude, and it reflects God the Father's attitude in us, his project, his workmanship. And so God says, your character will become like this beautiful, spiritually beautiful campus, and that God is going to provide power to make that happen. He'll renew your strength. He'll guide you and guard you. And then he says, okay, your character is going to be like that, and then your son shall build once more the ancient ruins and the old foundations. You'll build that character, and then you'll go out and recreate that physical beauty over all of the earth. I'll read one final passage in Isaiah chapter 51. Isaiah 51 and verse 16. One of my favorite scriptures. It says here, "I've put my words in your mouth. I've covered you in the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundation of the earth and say unto Zion, you are my people." In the Jerusalem temples booklet, Mr. Flurry writes, "Understand this deeply. God is going to plant the heavens." He says, "God is going to undertake a massive building project out in the cosmos to make the universe exquisite. That is what scripture reveals. God is going to extend his government throughout the universe." And he references Isaiah 9 and verse 6 to 7 and 45 and verse 18. "He is giving you the opportunity to help him rule and plant the heavens." So God wants to build a passion for perfection in our lives. And we learn how to do that. And we need to get started in overcoming our problems and keep going, keep perfecting. He builds that in our lives. And then we go out and we bring a passion for perfection out into the universe or onto the world first, perfecting that whole world, and then out on into the universe. Just an eternal striving for perfection. I think that's just one of the wonderful visions that you can get walking around God's headquarters campus. It really is inspiring to see what he's been doing here and just the vision that's bound up in that. It's been I've just been here a few days, but I've really enjoyed coming back here. Well, that is about all that we have time for. Please do tune in tomorrow. I believe if everything goes to plan, I think Brent Nachtigall is guest hosting, and they are right in the midst of a dig in Israel. They've just got all of the latest Hebrew University's volunteers, I think, started showing up on Sunday. So it's really going in earnest. I'm looking forward to, I don't know what, he might say nothing about that, but I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say. He always has something very interesting to say regardless. So please do tune in to tomorrow for that. If you want to order any of the material, once again, 1-866-930-3024. You can email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Visit us on the website, thetrumpet.com. However you do it, be very happy to hear from you.